raised with regard to a fundamental yahadus. This seems to be the ultimate foundation. That is to say, person, I assume most people that keep the Torah do so because they believe that the Torah is from God. That seems to be the basis. If you believe in the Torah is from God, so you really don't have any choice. You're obligated, if you're Jewish, anyway. As far as the Gentile is concerned, there's a different issue. Perhaps we'll come back to that. Parenthetic. All right, so we're going to start off with something that it's an incident that occurred. A major rabbinical figure who's Orthodox wrote a book called The Dignity of Difference. And in the book, you have the following quote. Quote, God has spoken to mankind in many languages. Through Judaism to Jews, Christianity to Christians, Islam to Muslims. End of quote. Now the article says, the book also posits. I just want to make it clear that I don't have the book in front of me, and I'm basing myself purely on what's been reported in this article. And dealing with it. So they thought, it doesn't make that much difference to me anymore whether, in fact, it was taken out of context or not taken out of context, because we're reacting to it as though this was the intention. So even if it's not the intention of the author, that's not my interest. My interest is the ideas. How would you react if somebody actually posited this idea as it's being interpreted in the paper? The article says that the book also posits that, quote, no one creed has a monopoly on spiritual truth. No one civilization encompasses all the spiritual, ethical, and artistic expressions of mankind. In heaven, there is truth. On earth, there are truths. Quote, God is greater than religion. He is only partially comprehended by any faith. The question that we're dealing with is the sense. The one who wrote these sentences claimed that it was taken out of a certain context. Whatever. So I don't know what the context was. And I'm not really interested. We're just going to deal with it as assuming that this was the intention. But in another defense, the person said that it was directed towards a non-Jewish audience. So that's another defense of these statements. And unfortunately, by accident, it was placed, because there were excerpts from the book in a Jewish newspaper. So that was a mistake because I assume he's saying that he can understand how Jews might be upset. Jews might be offended. But it wasn't intended for a Jewish audience. It was intended for a non-Jewish audience. And the question that we're raising is, now we're going to take these sentences as though this is the intent. We're taking them at face value. That is a statement that Judaism is not the only truth, and Christianity has truth, and Islam has truth. He doesn't go any further, but I don't know what we'd go beyond that. And let's say a person were to say that, but say, look, I didn't direct that towards a Jewish audience. I directed it towards a Gentile audience, a non-Jewish audience. And the question we're asking is, would that make a difference? Would that then exonerate, so to speak? Okay? Someone's raising the issue that perhaps in front of, but then according to that, would that be permissible? You're saying that that maybe he doesn't really believe this, maybe he doesn't mean this, but it was intended as some kind of an introduction. L'shabres ha'ozen, so to speak, yeah. Break the ears, to grab somebody's attention.
Yeah.
The use of hype, sometimes, in order to get people interested in the topic, so you'll use some type of a dramatic expression. Even though that's not what you mean, and you know it's going to be misconstrued, and because it's going to be misconstrued, so people are going to come to hear you, and when they come to hear you, then you'll discuss the idea correctly, in accordance with the truth. And to back this up, it's a question being raised, whether that's indeed what took place in terms of the Gemara mentions about Hillel, the famous Machlokas Hillel and Shammai, about the convert, the Gentile that came and said, I'll convert to Judaism if you can teach me the Torah. If you teach me the entire Torah while I'm standing on one foot. Famous story. So, basically Shammai, he rejected him, threw him out. because at face value it would seem that that type of a request is absurd. Because the Torah is very complex. And not to say that before you convert you have to be a master or advanced scholar, but that even to obtain an understanding of the basics, you see that's important. That to gain sufficient understanding of the foundations that a ger would have to become aware of is something which you can't just give over in a few minutes or one session. I don't know if it was literal while I'm standing on one foot. That's like a few seconds. I don't know. That's basically the idea. It's an exaggeration, but they meant quickly. It's an interesting thing. I wonder if the same could be true to say of other religions. I think most religions don't require any utilization of love. It's not based upon knowledge and learning and understanding. To the contrary, they discourage that in a certain emotion. So the person professes faith, and you just overcome with faith, and can you just induct me into your system, and while I'm standing on one foot, I think most religions would be very happy. Because they welcome the converted, it doesn't really, it's not based upon understanding and knowledge. I mean, it's an important lesson from Shammai. Everybody emphasizes Hillel's role. Because Hillel, again, people have come to view that as being an expression of tolerance and love. So people like that. It's more emotionally pleasing. But the position of Shammai has always been, criticized. He was exclusive. He wasn't inclusive. He didn't embrace him. He pushed him away. So people just don't like that. People like the, so to speak, the nice guy. That's why they assume that Hillel, it was all his personality. It's not a clash of ideas, but his personality was warm and he was embracing. But Shammai, you learn something very, very significant about Judaism. You learn it from both. I mean, it's not that Hillel denies that Judaism is based upon profound knowledge and ideas. The question is, can you capsulize? Can you capsulize the essence of Torah in a brief type of a heading, a brief type of an expression? And Shammai said, no, can't do that. But Hillel is interesting. The person is studying it objectively, without any type of a prejudice. It seems to me that the Shammai is the one that makes more sense. How can you sum up the Torah? Especially while a person is standing in a short period of time, in a simple pasuk, that v'ahavta kamocha, you should love your neighbor as yourself. That's the answer that he'll get. That's the essence, and the rest is just a footnote, so to speak. Go and study. This is what Torah is all about. Now, that's very questionable. Because is this the sum total of Torah? That's a separate problem. That it's true that the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha is a mitzvah. It's one mitzvah. And it's a very important mitzvah. But what about the other mitzvahs? What about what the Rambam says, that the purpose of Kol Torah Kulo is really to obliterate idolatry. And so therefore all of mankind can have a recognition of the true God. That all of mankind is mechuyev to free itself from idolatry and to have a recognition and an awareness of the existence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu as a fundamental foundation. So what about that? He doesn't mention that. It's true that the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro is significant. Between man and man is very significant. But it's hard to imagine. I don't know why he would pick out that particular one. So that's a question that we have to ask. The question is, was it simply a different approach that Hillel's approach was, that this person is interested in Judaism, and he doesn't want to turn him away, and he knows that most people, before they're instructed in Torah, aren't on a level where they're capable of appreciating. Many of the mitzvos of Judaism, which have to do between man and God, and which at least on the surface may not appear to them to be that important. Building a sukkah and eating matzah and so forth may not appear on the surface as being that important, whereas you have to have come up with something everybody can relate to. So that's the question. Was that his purpose? That he knew that everybody relates to that. And if a person hears that in this situation, you have someone who's expressing an interest. So if you hit him with that idea, that'll make an impression and he'll continue. He'll go and learn. If you just tell him nothing, he'll go away. You'll lose him. That's one possibility. Or no, that's really true. That he really held, if you understand the Kol HaTorah Kulo, then you'll see that everything really relates back to the Haftarah Echmach. That's the question that has to be raised. Now, for the time being, let's assume that the first possibility, that he's not really saying that the Haftarah Echmach, which is significant, but it's not, it doesn't sum up Kol Tarah Kula. True. Does not. So why? But he said it because it's functionally, it serves a good purpose. That the objective is to win the person over. And that idea is not such a terrible idea, because if you're trying to spread Judaism, so you're invited to address a group of Jews that aren't really affiliated, but they're interested in Judaism, they're not really practicing. So what topic do you choose? So you know that there's different topics. There are some topics that are going to be more challenging, more complex, go against their emotions. That they, you know, because they're influenced by what's going on in the society today. So maybe you're better off avoiding those topics. Why take on, even though you can elucidate it and you can explain it, but you're going to meet a lot of resistance. They're not ready for it. But maybe if you won them over slowly but surely and they had more confidence in the Torah, that's very important, by the way, to know in Kiruv. When you're working with people, that there are certain issues that you really should try and avoid, unless you can't help it, and they raise the issues. But there are many things in the Torah that are going to be very challenging to people. And even though you could explain it logically, but they're not on a level yet emotionally where they can relate to it. So let's say you discuss something that they can accept, like the idea of returning the lost object and the Haftarah Echmach, that if a Jew is stuck on the road, you have to stop for him. Those types of things, where essentially people's emotions are in line. So then they'll enjoy it and they'll feel a positive impression, and then they'll come back to you, and, you know, eventually they'll make some kind of transformation, because it can't be pleasant forever when you're doing this kind of thing. Eventually you're going to reach a point where it's a conflict and you have to take a stand. And then you have to really show them why, you know, they're just being influenced by their emotions, and it's not really, in terms of if they could separate from their emotions, they could see that this makes more sense, this is true. Then that comes later. So now, it's being suggested that perhaps this is what Hillel was doing, and if that's the case, so could that defense be utilized in this situation? Maybe that's what the rabbi is saying. That he didn't mean this for a Jewish audience. He was speaking, or addressing the book, actually, I guess, to a non-Jewish audience. And for them, that's what you have to say. Otherwise, you're going to turn them off. The problem with the analogy, even if you say that Hillel's essential purpose was to say something which he knew would be acceptable to this individual, and if he's not making an objective, it's not an objective statement. So I guess you might have a similar thing. Like, he wouldn't have said this in front of an audience, you know. People that just want to hear truth. Still, there's a difference. Because it's not really a falsification of Torah. I don't think it's a falsification. This type of a statement that the Torah is something less than absolute. That the Torah that was given to us with revelation, the highest possible level of Nevuah, prophecy. That's a fundamental principle of the Torah. You know that, to take a look at the Gimli Karm of the Rambam, that one of the Karm is the phenomenon of prophecy, that God communicates to mankind. And that communication, by the way, the Rambam says that one of the purposes of the of the Messiah, of Avraham Avinu, by the Akedah. One of the purposes, had two purposes. One of the purposes was to demonstrate for mankind the absolute veracity of Nevuah. Because why would a person do something which is absolutely contrary to all of his emotions and to all of his entire sense of what's right and wrong, to actually be prepared to slaughter, to sacrifice his own son, unless he was absolutely convinced that he had no choice, that this is the will of God, and that's the ultimate reality. That's correct. That's sort of like the secondary purpose. The primary purpose was with regard to demonstrating how far a person has to go in terms of their love and fear of God. That's the ultimate level of a person's closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's living completely in the realm of the will of God, no matter how it affects anything that he's attached to in terms of his emotional makeup. Even the most prized possession, and especially in the case of Avram, that he longed for the child and couldn't have a child, you know, all the factors which would increase his attachment to this child, but all that were the Dvar Hashem. Ultimately, when it came to a conflict with this is the Dvar Hashem, that's it, that's his reality. So, but that's the secondary purpose is, one thing leads to another. Because you'll say, well, a person in that situation is going to have all kinds of doubts and rationalizations. How do I know that I'm doing the right thing? Maybe I didn't get it clearly. If there was any kind of a defect, if there was any kind of a lack of clarity in Nevuah, if Nevuah wasn't absolute in terms of a person's knowledge being able to recognize the truth, it was absolutely clear to him, so why he wouldn't do it? In that situation, if he was in doubt, let's say he couldn't interpret it. Because the Nevuah is not direct. It's not that God is transmitting words to him. It's in a vision. It's something that has to be deciphered. All the Nevi'im received their prophecy indirectly, so to speak, through some type of a mashal, an analogy, a prophetic vision or a prophetic dream, which afterwards they had to decipher. We see the clear illustration of that, and the Torah has many illustrations of that. The case of Paro, for example. Paro did not dream. Paro wasn't really a Navi. Paro wasn't a Navi, but God transmitted, actually like used him. He was sort of like an object. God transmitted the prophetic message in his dream, but he didn't know what to do with it, other than that he was very upset. But the Pam Rucho, his heart was pounding. And he needed an interpreter. Someone who knew how to interpret the true prophecy, which was encoded in a dream. So Yosef had that knowledge. The dreams of Yosef also were Nevuah. And but Yosef knew how to interpret it. The brothers denied that it was really prophetic. They maintained that it was an ordinary psychological phenomenon. It was reflective of his own instincts, his own desires. Therefore, the Rambam says that all of the prophets, all the Nevi'im, did not receive the message from God clearly as one person would speak to another and give a direct communication, a direct order, or whatever it might be, except Moshe Rabbeinu. Nevertheless, you shouldn't think that prophecy is not reliable. But because of this fact, because it requires interpretation, and you may say, well, if there's interpretation, maybe it's the wrong interpretation. The Rambam is making the point that one of the objectives of the Akedah was to establish the absolute veracity. Because Nevuah is not given to an ordinary individual. A Navi is someone who is the most perfected of the human species in terms of knowledge, in terms of his ability to control his emotions, in terms of living in accordance with objective truth. So, therefore, Avraham Avinu, who was a perfected individual, he wasn't a zealot, a crazy religious fanatic. To the contrary, he based his entire life on chachma, knowledge, so he would not do a thing. He was a perfect illustration for this test. Would not do something like this, the greatest evil, unless he was absolutely convinced that he had to, that it came from God. He lived his whole life in the principle of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, being subservient to the will of God. So, now, as far as the Moshe Rabbeinu was concerned, that is a separate principle of the Yud Gimel Karim. That Nevuah Moshe, in spite of the fact that ordinary Nevuah is absolute, and there's no doubt about it, still, God wanted the Torah to be transmitted to us at an even higher level of Nevuah. Moshe Rabbeinu was the Adon HaNevi'im, was in a qualitatively different class. And one of the differences between Moshe and the other Nevi'im is this phenomenon of Pel Peh Dalavo, that God communicated ideas directly to Moshe, not through any intermediary, not through something which had to be deciphered. So therefore, it's a fundamental principle of Yahadus that God's revelation to us is absolutely true. It's not the truth, like many truths. Many truths. Many truths has to do with something where, you know, you don't know what the truth is. There's no way. You're dealing with issues that we really can't resolve, unresolvable issues. So it's unresolvable issues, so then you have people forming intelligent people. Not everybody's opinion is valid, but even, but amongst wise people, people who can come to some types of conclusions, so you have different opinions, so to speak. But that's not the case of Torah, that's absurd. So therefore, if we accept, the person accepts Torah, he has to know what he's accepting. He's not just saying, I like it. If a person, this connects us to the other question, that a person that says he doesn't really have any need to know whether there's any proof that Torah is from Sinai, he believes. The question, that's the original question that we began the discussion with, to which we're going to return. However, the foundation of keeping the Torah must be because it was given at Sinai. Whether the person says he needs proof of that, or whether he says he has faith in that, I think everybody would agree that if a person says, I don't believe in Sinai, but I'm going to keep the Torah anyway. Why isn't that a yoga? We could ask that individual, by the way, what's the difference between him? The argument was that from a practical standpoint, I'll keep them just as conscientiously on the basis of faith, of Amuna, as I would if I had no. He's actually arguing that faith is better. Because he's saying that it can't be shared if you have based on proof, so then if you discover something else, if anybody should discover something which is contrary to our proof, so then it would remove it. But if it's not based on proof, so if it's based on faith, so then it's immune, so to speak. We'll take that question up a little bit later. But for the time being, this person is acknowledging, though, that if you don't believe that there was a Sinai, that's also a defect in the argument. If you don't believe, if your approach to Torah is not rooted in Sinai, it's nice. It's a nice system. I think, now let's say, if a person has that belief, he's not going to keep it when it's inconvenient. That's true. Practically speaking, it probably won't be able to be maintained under all circumstances. But let's say, for argument's sake, that it could be, that the person is completely committed to keeping it. Would that have any validity? Would one's observance of the Torah, all the mitzvahs, except, of course, he doesn't believe in God, you know, that God, it's very difficult, because those mitzvahs that are interconnected with the whole revelation would be difficult for him to keep with any kind of kavanah. The fundamental idea when a person accepts the fact that the Torah was given by God, when he accepts Sinai, the idea of Sinai, then you have to understand what comes with it. If that is the case, then it stands to reason that this is God's revelation to mankind. This is the will of God with regard to the perfection of mankind. That's clear in the Torah itself. And the idea that any change, any alteration of the Torah, even though the Torah has a mitzvah about that, I think on the basis of logic we could come to the same conclusion. If a person doesn't know about the mitzvah, that you may not add to the Torah, you may not detract from the Torah. That's a specific mitzvah. But it's rooted in this idea that the Torah is Hashem Temeva, that the Torah is perfect. This represents God's revelation to mankind, and that's it. There's not going to be another revelation. To say that we can add to it, or to say that there could be something else besides this, is to disparage the idea that it comes from God. Because if it comes from God, then it's perfect. If you're going to say it's imperfect, then you're going to attribute imperfection to God. If you're going to say that it's only temporary and it's going to be superseded, so again, you're going to deny Torah. The Torah itself makes it plain that this is lanu ulvanenu ad olam. That idea that once the Torah is given, even though we do have the phenomenon of prophecy, that's part of Torah. The only reason why we have prophets coming to us afterwards and we accept prophets is because that's a mitzvah of the Torah, that we should listen to the Navi. And if a person doesn't listen to the Navi, disobeys the word of a proper, of a legitimate Navi, so he's chayev misa b'day shemayim, death by the heavenly court. But if the Navi, one of the ways in which we test the Navi, is if a Navi, that is to say someone who passes all the tests of Nebuah, and even someone that we've accepted in the past, if a Navi comes to us and says that the God spoke to him and God sent a message, which would be to add a new mitzvah. Now from now on, we should do this particular act. We should observe the Yom HaShoah, let's say. And he has a whole format, a program of how to observe it. And this, let's take Bezman Hazer. We had a legitimate Navi. And he passed all the tests. Because he has to, first of all, he has to be the extremely advanced scholar, all the personal qualifications. A perfected individual. And he has to prove himself by predicting events in the future. And they all come true down to the last detail. That's another misunderstood issue. You know, prediction is a... You know, every so often people get caught up in some great personality and he prophesied this, you know, during the Persian Gulf War. These are things, the kind of things they usually cite. Like, you know, nobody should leave the area. Like there's a hurricane in Florida. So he said that nobody should leave. No Jews would be hurt. And then it turns out that, well, to the best of my knowledge, no Jews were hurt. These are general kind of things. It's got to be something which is very specific, very particular, that nobody could have known, or it couldn't have been fortuitous. Because you know, a lot of times you say, don't worry, things will be okay, and it bypasses you. So, I mean, anybody could say that, and then afterwards say, look, I'm a prophet. These types of things, it would be like today, it would seem that the country is drawing closer to a war against Iraq. Seems that way. Bush spoke to the nation last night. So, of course, this entails the danger that Israel could be attacked. All right, so now I can go on record right now saying that Americans and Israel shouldn't come home, don't be afraid, you're safe in Israel. Since you went there to learn, that type of thing, let's say I would do that. And I put it in an envelope and I told you guys to put it away. And now the war is coming closer and closer, and you see the scenes, at airports, Americans, Jews are coming back home because they're afraid that Hussein will attack. And I'm saying, no, stay there, there's nothing to worry about. Okay, so then the war comes, and he made a few attempts. Hussein did make some attempts to send some scouts to the border, but they were detected. They were knocked out. And it turns out the whole war lasted six and a half minutes, and Hussein was completely defeated, and not one Israeli was hurt. And everybody's celebrating. Is that then? There is this emotion. So does that make me a prophet? Now I come out, not myself, because that would show some egotism. I'd have to have my students come out in front of me. Talmidim come out. Of course, we knew it all along. We have another here, and they predicted that there's no danger. So would that be sufficient? That's the kind of thing. See, there's a very strong emotion after the fact. People are always looking. There's a powerful desire to find a prophet that can predict the future. But the truth of the matter is that that's either a fortuitous, it's a guess, or a guy that has a little smarts and that. First of all, you know that there's a very good chance that it won't happen anyway. It's just that people are so afraid that when you're afraid, your emotion convinces it's going to happen. So that's why people are leaving the country. They have a strong conviction that, and that didn't happen, it was a miracle. Oh, it was a miracle. I predicted it. See, that's the way people's emotions work, and if they don't have knowledge that in order to establish prophecy, then you have to, 6 months before the event, say in 2001, or even in June, when you're talking about the World Trade Center and you're talking about September 11th and you're saying specifically what kind of planes and where they're coming from and the towers and what floor, you had predicted that, and then the event occurs, and then we go back and you had everything identical, then we're talking seriously, you see? And I'll tell you the truth, not even 2 months, even a day before. Even a day before. Now, unless, even that couldn't have been, even if you couldn't, when I say it had to be before, because you have to rule out the possibility that this person had some way of finding out from Al-Qaeda, from the terrorists, I mean, maybe he had some kind of connection. But even that, even if you had that connection, even if you knew about the attack, you would not have been able to predict what floor. It was impossible that on the plane they knew what floor they were aiming for. It was a general target. So if you had, even then, if you were able to predict it and the specifics, then you're talking. Because you're dealing in the realm of things that nobody can really know. There's no way for a person to know. There has to be some kind of revelation to him from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it's a fundamental of Yahadus that if you accept the foundation that Torah is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, So it's absolutely complete. It's complete. That's why a prophet comes along and says that God ordered me to, wants to add another mitzvah, and I will have 614 mitzvahs, or we'll have 615 mitzvahs, is put to death because he's a Navi Sheker. He's a false prophet. Because he's coming to add to the Torah. He's denying the whole Torah. Prophet, any prophet that comes, that uses prophecy to say that God is, to say that the Torah is null and void, can't be in it. Can't be a Navi Enos. It's only in the framework of the Torah. So all the prophets that came after Moshe, it wasn't to add to the Torah. It was only to lead, to help the Jews, to warn them, or to instruct them what they should do, and so forth. But the idea that that God is adding a mitzvah or removing a mitzvah is a contradiction to the very fundamental idea of Torah, that it's perfect.
He said only in person.
Got a few. I'm going to take up another aspect of the question on the premise of whether you're permitted to falsify the Torah in order to make it more popular or to gain adherence. The question has been raised, what about the case in the Gemara about Hillel and Shammai regarding the prospective convert who came and said that he would convert to Judaism if you could give over the entire essence of the Torah while standing on one foot? It became a very famous expression. Meaning to say, in a short period of time, without lengthy explanation and study and all of that. So Shammai dismissed them, which makes a lot of sense, because it seems on the surface to be an absurd request. Whether or not you have to deal with a person that makes such a request, it's another issue. But on the surface, Shammai seems to make sense. It doesn't matter. If you're interested in Judaism, Judaism is not simplistic. And in order to become a convert, it doesn't mean that you have to study for many, many years until you've mastered all of Torah. That's not the requirement. But you have to have a grasp of the fundamentals, of the basics. There are some very significant ideas, so it takes time. A certain amount of study is required. So the request that just quickly give it over to me in a capsule is not legitimate. However, Hillel, apparently, perhaps he went within Mishur HaDin, beyond what the law requires, and he was accommodating. And the answer was, yeah, V'yahach l'recha kamocha. You shall love your friend. By the way, friend over here doesn't mean someone who you're friendly with. It means a fellow Jew. Every Jew, stranger or what you or not, is considered to be re'acha, your friend. And you have an obligation to love him as you love yourself. Okay, it's the essence, so to speak. And the rest is commentary. And go and learn. The question that has been raised is, was he really serious? Did he really mean that? Is that his conception? Or did he say that because he thought that that would be acceptable? That's something the person would like. One can raise the question, there's many other things in the Torah besides V'yahach l'recha kamocha. All the requirements in terms of God, in terms of the negation of idolatry, in terms of keeping Shabbos, and so on and so forth. So the way the question is being presented, I believe, is that one can make the case that Hillel had an objective, that he wanted not to lose this person. He wanted to win this person over, because the person did show a certain interest. And perhaps he felt that if he would have mentioned some of the more complicated or challenging or less popular things, then the person would have been turned off. And therefore he chose something which has universal appeal. All different religions uphold that idea.
But also at any stage where you're at in religion, that always means... But you can always add on to that.
What's being asked is whether there's a certain amount of falsification or distortion. Is that really true? If someone asks you seriously to sum up the essence of Judaism, would that be a true answer? Did he tell him the truth, or did he give an answer which he thought would be acceptable and pleasing in order that he shouldn't lose him with the idea that he'll continue to study, and eventually he'll find out the truth. And if that is what he did, so then the question is, perhaps we do see from there that it is permitted, and to a certain extent, to shade the truth, or however you want to put it. Isn't that your question?
Yeah.
With this idea that someone's going to come to you, wants to know about Judaism, and you tell them the essence of Judaism is how you treat your fellow man.
Right.
If that's it, that's your final statement, and that's definitive, so to speak. That's definitive. To me, that's a falsification. There are many people that have that idea. For example, the Reform Jews, conservative Jews, mainly Reform, want to maintain that all the rituals, so to speak, rituals, Shabbos, and tefillah, and tefillin, all these things that are, so to speak, or kashrut is what they, really aren't that significant. Because bottom line, it's being in your master, how you treat your fellow man, that's the real thing. It's kindness, it's compassion. That's the essence. Sorry, what? That'd be legitimate. If somebody were to definitively state that this is it, that's what Judaism cares about. Judaism is only concerned about how you behave towards others. Would that be true, or would that be a falsification?
Well,
it's really false. For example, many people today want to claim they're good Jews, and they want to take the whole area of control of sexual morality. That's irrelevant to goodness. That's purely a matter of personal taste. And therefore they want to justify all types of different expressions of sexual behavior, whether it's homosexuality and other types of activities which are prohibited by the Torah. And these people, many of these would be even rabbis, so-called Reform rabbis, would have no problem with that, saying that's a matter of personal taste. And how can you arbitrate? How could you decide that this is correct? I mean, it's fine. You're a heterosexual, so that's fine. Well, these people are homosexual, so that's fine. So what's the difference? It's a matter of personal taste or orientation. That's the big word today, orientation. But what difference does it make? This person is just as good as you are. This person is righteous. This person helps people. As long as you're a good person helping people, what difference does it make what you indulge in? That's an argument that they would make. If this is totally false, honesty demands that we state the truth. The Torah maintains that this is a serious evil, that these types of actions are sanctioned by the death penalty, and therefore it's false. It's absolutely false to say that these things don't matter, and the only thing that matters is how you treat other people, and no one's interested in your sexual orientation. Is absolutely false. The Torah rejects that idea. Okay? Or if you were to go to a group of people and tell them that all we care about is how you treat others and nothing else matters, you'd be falsifying the Torah. I don't think I can make a distinction between that and the criticism of those rabbis that said that there's many truths and other religions also have some truths. You follow? So your question is strong. The rest of this commentary does not extricate the statement from the problem, because what you mean when you make a statement like that, this is what it is. The rest of this commentary means it's just an application, an expansion. It's nothing. There's nothing else up there that's important.
It's not.
That you're not going to find anything else. Except, this point has to be elucidated in many, many ways. So that's the commentary.
But in the
case can be made that it's the statement is true. There's truth in the statement. The statement is true. I'm not saying that Hillel would have made this statement on his own, that Shistam, to formulate Torah, this is Torah. But he was challenged to do so, and he held that this would be appropriate, that this would be effective, and this would lead the person to continue. The question, however, still remains, does the statement, is it true? Can it be justified in terms of truth? Now, it seems to me, for example, you go into the Rambam and the Moreh Nevuchim, and he explains that really the mitzvot of the Torah have two objectives, two purposes. You have the Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim. This would be in chapter 27, part 3, in the paperback edition, page 312. We study Moreh Nevuchim. They don't study Moreh Nevuchim. The Yeshiva discusses this idea in a number of places. but we'll just focus on this one. He talks about the purpose of the Torah. The general object of the law is twofold. By object, it means purpose, objective. The well-being of the soul and the well-being of the body. The well-being of the soul is promoted by correct opinions communicated to the people according to their capacity. It's amazing. Like, this is not. These opinions are therefore imparted in a plain form, others allegorically. Because certain opinions are in their plain form too strong for the capacity of the common people. So that deals with, that's the primary objective of the Torah. To communicate essential truths to the person, which has the effect of perfecting the soul.
He says according to the plain capacity.
The well-being of the body is established by a proper management of the relations in which we live one to another. This we can attain in two ways. First, by removing all violence from our midst. That is to say that we do not do everyone as he pleases, desires, and is able to do. But every one of us does that which contributes towards the common welfare. Secondly, by teaching every one of us such good morals as must produce a good social state. The general purpose of the Torah is twofold. It makes, when you think about it, it's perfect sense. We're talking about the perfection of the individual, his spiritual perfection. Then there's this phenomenon of moral perfection, which really has to do with the fact that man is a social animal. And man can't live by himself. It's an impossibility. So in order for him to achieve his objective, he has to live in a society. And in order to have society, you have to have a certain state of harmony.
Why is that?
Thinking of the soul, or the communication of correct opinions, comes undoubtedly first in rank. But the other, the well-being of the body, the government of the state, and the establishment of the best possible relations among men, is anterior in nature and time. It means there's two ways of looking at it, which comes first, so to speak. When you say which comes first, which is the more significant? In terms of the significance, the perfection of the soul is the ultimate objective. More significant, of course. The other, the perfection of the society, is a means to that. Practically speaking, the way God designed mankind and the universe, man must live in a social context or he cannot obtain any of these benefits. So that has to come first. Practically speaking, which comes first? The social. You have to establish a effective and smooth social order. That comes first in time, because that's the means. The social is the means, but the end is that this should be utilized for the sake of the spiritual perfection. Better object is required first. It is also treated in the Torah most carefully and most minutely, because the well-being of the soul can only be obtained after that of the body has been secured. For it has already been found that man has a double perfection. The first perfection is that of the body, and the second perfection is that of the soul. The first consists in the most healthy condition of his material relations. And this is only possible when man has all his wants supplied as they arise. By the way, this has his food and other things needful for his body. For example, shelter, bath, and the like. But one man alone cannot procure all this. It is impossible for a single man to obtain this comfort. It is only possible in society, since man, as is well known, is by nature social. The second perfection of man consists in his becoming an actually intelligent being, i.e., he knows about the things in existence, all that a person perfectly developed is capable of knowing. The second perfection certainly does not include any action or good conduct, but only knowledge, which is arrived at by speculation or established by research. All right, Kikka has been raised with regard to via haftarah and kamalka. Has been raised by psychologists and other critics that this is really something which is impossible. If you think about it, how is it possible? It's not in human nature. Because a person is selfish. Everybody is selfish by nature. And here it says the Torah is commanding you to love Reacha, to love your friend. That itself would be very, very difficult, because it's commanding you to love any fellow Jew, whether you know the person or don't know the person. So, let's be honest, each person has a small circle of people. I would say the overwhelming majority of people that you confront or meet, you don't have that feeling that you love them. And it's only a few. It depends upon accidental factors. So how can you have a command that forces you to have this emotion when it's totally contrary to your nature? It's not in the nature of people to love strangers. And how can you command a thing like that? It even goes further and it says, kamocha, like you love yourself. It would have been difficult enough if it simply said that you're obligated to love everybody. But to go to that extent that you love yourself, that's impossible. Everybody loves themselves the most. To duplicate that, maybe a few relations, maybe you have a child, or very close, your wife, whatever the case may be, it's going to be very, very minimal that a person can achieve that degree of love. And yet, the other Torah is saying, no, you're obligated to have this attitude, this feeling, apparently, towards everybody. I want to pause, okay? And bearing in mind what we just read over here. Before we proceed to try and answer the question that was raised concerning Hillel's famous answer. That Hillel said to the would-be convert that the entire Torah essentially is v'ahavta rech kamocha. That you should love your friend as yourself. The rest is, so to speak, commentary. Question being whether that is some kind of a falsification that was done in order to win the person over. Before we get to that point, being raised that it seems that it's okay to refrain from delving into certain areas of Torah which you think will be unpopular. Is that the same thing? For example, let's say you're talking to a group of women that are very strong feminists. So if they knew, for example, the Torah's concept of marriage and divorce, that really it all revolves around the man and the woman can't give him a divorce. It's up to him to give her a divorce. All these types of things, given their state of mind right now, the way they would look at these things would be negative. So you're going to give a talk about Judaism, and you'll select. You'll select areas. And in selecting the areas, you'll select those areas which you think your understanding is that they'll have the least resistance to accepting. Areas that don't impinge, that don't conflict with their predispositions or their emotions. So the question is being raised, is that also dishonest by refraining from certain areas because you think it would give the wrong impression? Is that the same problem? As also with regard to, let's say you're talking to a group of gay people or homosexuals, and the question comes up about Torah's attitude towards homosexuality. There too, there may be a very strong temptation to try and gloss over it, to try and present the Torah's position as not being so opposed, which is absolutely forbidden. It's false. The Torah is clearly opposed to homosexuality. Not just opposed. It condemns it. It's a very, very serious affair. It carries the death penalty. And one is not permitted to flinch from that. You have to tell the truth. At the same time, you can make it clear that the Torah does not condemn an individual who happens to have that kind of an orientation. The Torah doesn't look at the person who has the orientation as being a bad person or as being evil or being at fault or being responsible. However, it's the behavior. It's the indulgence in the activity which is considered sinful. In the same way, a person that has any kind of a desire or a disposition to commit an aver, a person has a very powerful desire for adultery, for whatever reason. And that's the person's true lusting, so to speak, is for adulterous relationships. So the person can't be called evil. Whatever. We don't know the psychological factors that would produce that state, that attitude. As long as the person recognizes that it is wrong and it's prohibited and refrains from doing it, there's no sin. To the contrary, such a person is a tzaddik. A person that's homosexual orientation and recognizes that it's prohibited and refrains from doing it purely because God commands it, that person is a tremendous tzaddik. So that is permissible, that should be said. that there's nothing wrong with the person, because the person has no control in determining. I assume the person had nothing to do with it, didn't pursue this, didn't cultivate this within themselves. So people like that, that refrain from gratifying those desires purely because of the Torah, are on a much higher level than so-called heterosexuals that don't have to grapple with that. Okay? I'm sorry. Of avoiding issues which you determine to the best of your understanding, the other person is not ready to accept at this point, is a very intelligent thing to do. To the contrary, it would be wrong, I'm not using the word prohibited, but you could use that word, to deliberately challenge people in an area where you know that emotionally they can't accept it. You shouldn't do that. Because in a sense, you're leading them astray. You're causing them to err. It's sort of like if a person is a shogeg. A person is doing something b'shogeg. Certain types of errors. They're a banan. And you know that if you were to rebuke them, they wouldn't listen to you anyways. So you shouldn't rebuke them, because now you're making it worse for them, because before they were doing it b'shogeg. Now you tell them and they know, so now it's b'mezid. It's intentional. The same thing would apply over here.
You can't tell?
That's how you raise children. You deal with an adult in this area, they're like a child. You don't take up issues with a child that the child's intelligence is such that it couldn't accept it, and because you bring it up, they're going to reject Torah because of that. That does not make any sense, and you're under no obligation to do so. It's different if somebody asks you a question and you're going to falsify, that's falsification. So then you're trapped. If somebody asks you a very tough question, and you believe that if you were to tell them the truth, they really could not accept it, and they might reject Judaism, you're in a tough situation. So you may have to use, if you can, to get out of it, delaying tactics, whatever. I mean, but you can't falsify. You can't falsify Judaism because of that objective. However, that doesn't mean to say that you're obligated to challenge a person with the most difficult areas that you know they're not ready to accept. That doesn't make any sense. That's part of chinuch. In terms of education, you have to choose the material that the student is qualified, is prepared to understand. And it's absurd to force material on someone that they're not prepared to understand. Whether it's because of intellectual development, or whether it's because of their emotions at this point in time are not strong enough in terms of their commitment to Torah. That's the idea of lo lishma. So you win a person over, and as a person learns more and appreciates Torah more, they have a certain confidence in Torah. Then, and they have a certain attachment. Then, if they should encounter something that's challenging, they're not going to just give up the system so quickly. That makes perfect sense. Alright, now back to the question that we were dealing with. And the answer of Shammai. Was that a case of distorting the Torah in order to make it appealing? Now yesterday I began, right? I gave you a little of a beginning. Did it have any significance? One of them is there's two perfections. One of them is the perfection of the soul by communicating to a person true ideas, knowledge. The second one is the so-called moral virtues only because we're a social man is a social animal. And man lives in a social context. So in order to have the smoothest, the care of the body, he calls the body doesn't just mean physical. The body means your whole physical existence. So therefore, the Torah inculcates and teaches us proper ways of behavior in order to ensure the smooth running of society, which is absolutely essential, because without that we couldn't have the true perfection. But the real perfection, according to the Rambam, is less than the Bein Adam L'Chaveros, let me make this point. Yesterday we did the Rambam, and he mentions that there are two purposes. The Torah has two purposes, two perfections. One, he says, is the real perfection, the true perfection, is the perfection of the soul, which has to do with the acquisition of true knowledge, true ideas. The second one is the perfection of the physical aspect of existence, the social order. And in that heading, all these laws pertaining to how we're to behave, not to injure people, not to steal, not to murder, to be helpful to people, to return their objects. That's the secondary thing. because that it's possible to achieve the real perfection only in a social context, because man is a social animal. That's where we left off. On the surface, at first glance, this Rambam seems to make the issue even more difficult, because what Hillel was citing was that you shall love your neighbor as yourself, which seems to fall into the second category. Seems to have something to do with the harmony of the social order. Yes, as at first glance, it appears that the mitzvah of Yahavta L'Recha, that you shall love your neighbor as yourself, so to speak, seems to fall into the category of the second perfection. That it's something which governs, affects relationships, human relationships, the societal phenomenon. And that's true. There's no question about it. If the person was on a deserted island, this mitzvah obviously would not be applicable. But if you analyze it, go further than that, you'll see that Hillel, when he picked this particular one, there's many, many laws of the Torah that are in the realm of between man and man, the second category. He picked this one. It's very specific. And it has to do with another question that's been raised. That is to say, that does the Rama mean that there's a clear-cut difference between a mitzvah either falls into one category or it falls into the other category? Can there be an overlapping? Can there be mitzvahs that affect both, that impact upon both? That question has been raised, and it seems to me that the answer is yes. And v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, if you ask, is that essentially a mitzvah of the social order, or is that a mitzvah between man and God? The answer really is both. There's something very, very unique about this mitzvah. The reason why it's unique is because if you analyze it, it seems that this is something which is a practically impossible thing. It's an impossible thing to achieve. One can raise the question that the Torah is commanding us to do the impossible, because it's totally contrary to human nature. As I mentioned yesterday, it's how many people can achieve that level of loving everyone, every fellow Jew? Not just loving them, but loving them as themselves. The truth, the reality is that how many people does a person get to love in their life? Even a decent person. A person that likes people, but loved, that's very few. It's very few, I would say. The amount of people that you could say, honestly, I love them, and actually I love them as I love myself, I would think it's very restricted. I'm sure you can count it on the fingers of your hand. If so, if you have that many people in this, well, usually it's the person's closest people, his wife, his children, that's it. And even that's not so clear. People are dishonest. If people are totally honest, it'll be even less, but I don't want to stress people out. On the surface, if you look at it as a psychological phenomenon, it seems to be an impossibility. However, if you study the mitzvah, it's not a psychological phenomenon. The command is not to achieve a certain emotional state. The Rambam elucidates the mitzvah. Essentially, it means that you have to accord to your friend, to your fellow Jew, the same respect, the same rights, the same consideration that you would expect for yourself. You have to be concerned about his money just as you would be concerned about your money, about his honor just as you would be concerned about your own. It's really a behavioral phenomenon. That is to say that you have to treat him, let's put it this way, as though you actually love. You love yourself. That's like yourself. Everybody has a tremendous feeling of self-love, and because you love yourself, you are concerned about all your money, about your reputation, about your honor, and so forth. The basic idea is that you have to accord to him the same rights. You can't maintain, well, everybody has an idea, a feeling that's contrary. That is, we naturally feel that we're more important. And the rights of the other person do not appear to you as being that important. Yeah. What is the basis for this? What is the basis? I mean, it's very difficult to achieve, because that's a very powerful feeling. In reality, a person does not feel the significance of somebody else's life and concerns, unless it impacts on them. It's very, very difficult. So the question is, again, how do you achieve such a thing? And the answer is that the if a person understands from whence he derives his own rights as a human being, the things that he insists upon. And if a person is violated, they complain, my rights. The other thing is that a person just assumes that he is important, that he has a certain significance. But the truth of the matter is that the only reason why you have any rights at all is because you were created by God, and God endowed you with rights. It's God's rule that you should exist. It's not that if you negate God, then you have no rights at all. You can't talk about the idea of rights without God. Because then everything's an accident. If everything's an accident, there's no reason why anybody should be here. It just happened accidentally, so then why do I have to respect? On what basis do I have to respect you? What am I doing wrong if I just push you out of the way? So it's because of the recognition that God created you and God endowed you with a tzelem Elokim. So therefore, you have a purpose, and it's God's will that you should be permitted to achieve that purpose. Therefore, you have to recognize that the very same phenomenon, that God's will, which relates to you, relates equally to every other human being that God, in this case, we're talking about Jews. So you exist in a framework, and in that framework, you have rights, but the rights of the other person are just as strong as your own. There's no difference. So therefore, what you see is that the only way to achieve this is by a recognition of the existence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that we all exist because of the framework of God, that God created us, and God created us for a purpose. And in the context of that purpose, so you have to recognize the significance and the importance of everyone who is created but Salmo. That's a different kind of a concept. Therefore, you see that in order to achieve this, by the way, this was the perfection of Abraham. The reason why Abraham was chosen to be the father of the Jewish people is he discovered the true ideas. But once he discovered the true ideas, you see, he didn't keep it to himself. He was filled with Ahavas Hashem, and the Ahavas Hashem expressed itself in a concern for all of God's creatures, because he recognized that this is God's will, that they were created for a purpose, and he wanted to see to it that they achieved the real purpose. Not just to help them physically, but to help them in terms of the soul, the true ideas. So here you have a perfect merging of the two. That a person who's perfected in the realm of his relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a genuine knowledge and understanding of God and a relationship of Ahavas Hashem, so this automatically perfects him in the other area. That's Avraham Avinu. So that's why the mitzvah of the Ahavta L'Reach Kamocha, it's true, it expresses the ultimate philosophy of Torah. That is the philosophy of Torah. That a person has to perfect himself, and the way a person perfects himself is through their relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. To the extent that they reach a relationship which is Ahavas Hashem. And once they achieve that, so then they automatically want to perform chesed in terms of helping, being helpful to God's creatures, in order to fulfill their Ahavas Hashem. So the Torah is the perfect system where there's no conflict between the two areas. And that is that the perfected life of the individual, as well as the most beneficial existence of the society, is founded on a genuine foundation of Yedias Hashem. This is the ultimate truth. The rest is commentary. All the particular mitzvos will fit into that category, but that's the ultimate objective. If you want to know the ultimate, the perfected individual, it's the person who's like Avraham Avinu, where the foundation is based on renunciation of idolatry, correct ideas about God, a real Yedias Hashem, a real knowledge of God insofar as it's possible for a human being. And it's totally internalized. It's not just abstract knowledge. It's totally internalized to the extent that it governs every phase of the behavior significantly in the realm of how he treats other people. That's the ultimate truth. Ultimate truth. And, interesting, so you see that Hillel used tremendous wisdom over here. Wanted to be honest, straightforward, communicate something which contained the truth, because you can't lie. But also requires commentary. You got to keep studying it. If you study this idea, which he communicated something which, when the person hears it, is very pleasing, because everybody loves this idea. Okay. So he didn't just choose arbitrarily. Did pick something which is very, very attractive on a very superficial level, but if you continue to study, and you'll uncover the real ideas. There's no falsification over there. Okay? We got to an issue that's arisen. The question is, suppose somebody maintains that they really have no need for a foundation of proof. That's the question, that what's our obligation with regard to Torah? Every Jew is obligated to believe in the Torah, that the Torah is divine. The question is that belief something which has to emerge from reason, from study, from the facts, from rationality? Or, as most religious people, unfortunately a lot of them Jewish, but essentially all the other religions are based upon faith. To the best of my knowledge, there's no religion that bases itself on reason or on knowledge. To the contrary, they maintain that it's faith. I mean, reason is really a negative thing. It's an intrusion. Now, we maintain that the Judaism is different, that Yahadis is based upon knowledge. That if a person studies all the factors that pertain to it, one will come to a conclusion that the Torah is true. It's from Sinai. It's God's revelation. That's on the first level. The first level of relating to the fact that the Torah is true is because it comes from God. However, beyond that, once a person recognizes that, they just can't stop and say, okay, I know that, let me go on with my life. Then a person is supposed to study Torah all their life, and the more one studies, the more that's confirmed. Now you have first-hand knowledge, as they say. The more a person studies Torah and gets an insight into the depth and the wisdom, one sees that this is not a work of people. So that, of course, confirms. But we're talking now on the first level. And the question is, if someone maintains that they have absolute faith, they don't need any type of reason, any type of proofs, they have absolute faith that the Torah is true. And this will, in fact, they maintain that it's superior. Because the argument goes that if it's based upon knowledge, so then there's a danger, according to what they're saying, there's a danger that a person, someone will come up with a different idea or some other factor, whatever, and if it's based on knowledge, so that could change. If you receive new knowledge, then it'll change. Of course, you have to realize that the one who maintains that it should be based upon knowledge doesn't find that to be a problem. Because if you're basing your life on knowledge, and the only reason you're keeping the Torah is because you know that it's true, so then if it were conceivable, I maintain this is not conceivable, but if it were conceivable that person would discover that it's not true, then the person would abandon it, and that wouldn't be a question on the person. See, the very fact that you raise such a question, that anyone raises a question like that, is based upon the idea that knowledge really is not the ultimate thing. Or that being in line with truth is not the ultimate thing. What they're saying is, because if the truth is that this didn't happen, that it didn't happen, so then that's a bad thing. You won't believe it anymore. You should believe it whether it happened or not.
So really, these people are
really
like deniers.
Yeah, it doesn't make much. Same question to the person who maintains faith and say, you have faith. Let's say, but you still, you have to use your mind in existence. In any other area, you use your mind. Let's say your mind were to discover that everything is absolutely false. So just because you believed in it on the basis of faith, you're going to continue to do so? That's an interesting question. I maintain that even people of faith, who say they have faith, don't mean to say that they rule out any type of reason. It is true they're very resistant. The ideal situation for a pure person of faith would be to lock himself up in some kind of a sealed, hermetically sealed room and not be exposed to any information in any way, shape, or form that could have any bearing on the system.
Monks.
Yeah, monks, society, and has to use his mind and getting along with people and his job and whatever the case may be. I maintain that, let's take a look at other areas where people operate on the basis of something akin to faith, where they believe very strongly in certain things, not on the basis of knowledge, but on the basis of a very powerful emotion, which would be akin to faith. The question that we're asking is that impervious to knowledge? Is that immune to any type of enlightenment? Because this is really the question. The person is saying that faith is superior because it's immune. Once you have faith, you can't lose it. The question that I'm asking is that true? Is it true that once you have faith, you can't lose it? Or you can lose faith too? Such is the nature of the question at this point. the argument of the person who's saying that it's better to have faith than knowledge is in terms of the consequences. That the consequences will be that you'll always be practicing Judaism because it's based on faith. And you've removed danger, vulnerability. However, if you can say it's based on knowledge, so then there's always the danger that you can hear a different idea, or that somebody can refute your knowledge. And therefore, you may lose it. So the argument is that if you base it on faith, practically speaking, it's immune to any type of refutation. Now, I'm questioning that point. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
The people I would bring to mind, let's say a person has faith in their wife, or the wife has faith in the husband that he's loyal, and all of that. It's a very powerful, powerful emotion. Obviously, in all these cases, it's never based on knowledge. Most of the time, there's no way that it could be based upon knowledge. You meet someone, you fall in love with them, you have a certain feeling, and they induce that feeling that they're faithful. But that's not knowledge. You can't prove it. You don't even know the person, hardly. You know the person for the last 6 months or a year. Now, if you speak to such a person, that person will say, I'm totally convinced I have faith. And if you raise the question, well, maybe you should look into it, maybe you should study it and all that, the person will be resisting it. And they insist that they can rely that it's true because they have such a powerful feeling about it. By the way, I just want to make clear another thing, that the whole idea of faith is really absurd. It's based upon something which is false. It's based upon the idea that because I feel about something in a certain way, therefore it must be real, it must be true. That's what faith is saying. Because the question is, how do you know that what you believe in is actual? How do you know that it's true? How do you know this is what God wants you to do? There's nothing more absurd than basing your life on faith. A person does not do that in any area that matters to them, unless they're irrational. But most people have a certain rationality about things. With regard to medicine, health, money, and so forth, business, successful businessmen don't base themselves on faith. They base themselves on knowledge. Anyone who's successful in any endeavor bases himself on knowledge. To the extent that they deviate from that and just go by blind faith, they're fools. So therefore, any intelligent person knows that the feelings you have about reality are no barometer whatsoever to the actuality of it. So to say that in what we would regard as the most crucial questions of life, that is to say the existence of God, whether there is a God or whether there's not a God, and assuming there is a God, God's will for mankind, and what man must do in order to achieve the objective and thereby earn the good favor of God and earn the life of the world to come, all these things that are the major issues, to say here I abandon reason and I'm going to do it because I feel that way, would have to be the most absurd thing imaginable. Such a person is absolutely irrational to the point of insanity. It's absolutely insane to say, I'm not going to investigate this area. And I'm not going to let my mind decide this area. My portfolio, my investments, my house, my car, every area will be to the best of my logical ability. But the most important area, there I'm going to just assume that since I feel this way, it has to be true. Any person that lives their life that way, again, I repeat this, is insane. And any religion that maintains that a person should function this way is insanity. There you have Judaism, then you're going to be maintaining that Judaism is asking for a person to act insane, which is contrary to the whole of Judaism. But there are certain people that recognize that their ability to inquire is limited, yeah. They're not on the level where they can decide all these issues. That doesn't mean to say that this person just abandons themselves to faith.
Right.
That doesn't make sense. It means that even on that person's level, to the best of their intellectual abilities, they can make certain conclusions. Because that person, that'll be true in any area. In any area, any normal human being functions in accordance with knowledge. So therefore, you have people who are advanced businessmen, and they have more knowledge. Now, a person who has less knowledge, who's not as intelligent, not as advanced, is not going to say, well, I can't understand and grasp all the things about business that this person does, so therefore I'm just going to follow my emotions. That doesn't make sense. This person will also function with knowledge and understand that they're going to be on a different level, but to function rationally means that in any area you're basing yourself on knowledge to the greatest extent that's possible for you. Obviously, the example of a doctor. When you go to a doctor, so that's not your field, so you don't understand medicine, so how do you know that this doctor is better than any other doctor? Obviously, it would be best, ideally, if you had a mastery of medicine, and you can go in there and find out for yourself and decide who you're convinced has more knowledge. But that doesn't mean that when you go to a doctor, you're just going on the basis of faith or emotion. It is to say you have a different system you use. There's a system of experts. There's other factors that will indicate who's a better doctor than another one. Now, since you're limited in terms that you only can function by secondhand indications, it's not as great, it's not as accurate as someone who can get beyond that. Because within this framework, there are many people that reach high positions, doctors, and they may not be that good. And since you don't have the knowledge, you can't isolate that. That doesn't matter. You're still functioning with your mind. We're saying you're functioning with your mind. Your decision is based upon knowledge, the kind of knowledge that you have access to the greatest extent possible.
So the
same would be true with regard to Judaism. You know, at this point in time, you may not understand all the complexities, but there are very good logical reasons why you should practice Judaism, why it makes more sense to keep the Torah than any other system. Right? On your left. As far as this discussion, just get certain points down, because we've had a digression. And that is that Judaism is based upon the utilization of the mind. And it is only through the utilization of the mind, through knowledge, through truth, that a person can perfect themselves and have a relationship with God. Therefore, the foundation of the Torah, and in every respect, is that a person should keep this system, because this is something which was revealed in a manner which would be satisfying to all the requirements of the human intellect. That's what the Torah itself proclaims. That's the idea of Mama Har Sinai. And to start off with, if a person says they don't need this, they're denying the Torah to begin with. If it was the will of the Torah, the will of God, that people should relate to it on the basis of blind faith, then there would not have been the event of Sinai, because that removes faith. Faith is, the more you have knowledge, the less you have faith. And I maintain that there's a reason. The reason for this is, as we've said, for a person to base his life on the assumption of certain religious claims for which there is no evidence whatsoever is irrational, is absurd. I said it's insane. So why would the Torah, whose objective is to perfect the person precisely in the area of knowledge, is going to start off by telling a person to negate knowledge? It's absolutely absurd. One second. Also maintain that the argument that if a person bases themselves on faith, so it's kind of immune to refutation, I say that's false. Because there are many areas where a person operates on the basis of faith. It could be faith in your doctor, faith in a country. A lot of people believe their country, every nationalism. They believe in their country is moral and righteous and all of that. That's a very powerful emotion. And you can't argue with that. That's patriotism. That's loyalty to your country. And people that have that emotion of faith, if it could be in a person, they're absolutely convinced that their wife is faithful to them. And they don't need any proof whatsoever because they feel it that powerful. Now, I say that definitely is subject to refutation for that person. It may be that person is more resistant is more resistant. If someone implies that maybe your wife is not so faithful, they may get angry and they may resist. But when you confront them with the actual fact, if you have photographs of the person's wife with her lover or boyfriend, I don't know that person's... There may be some people that can never accept the reality, but most people will accept the reality. They may have a breakdown. But how can you... But why? You have faith. You have faith. Well, why should you change your position on the basis of facts? It was based on faith. It wasn't based on facts. Or the country that you believed in so firmly, and then you discover there's evidence that this country committed atrocities and destroyed the villages in Vietnam just by orders from on high, just wiped out people. And you believe that this could never be because your country is a decent country. So now you'd have to change your position. But why? It wasn't based upon knowledge in the first place. It was based upon faith. Therefore, if one could construe, if one could imagine any type of information which would clearly and absolutely, irrevocably, prove that Judaism is not true, that the claims of Judaism are not true, and it's a human invention, if that could be proven irrevocably, and I maintain that it can't, but it could, such that it would be impossible for any person, no matter how committed they are, they simply could not maintain that this was true. For example, I mean, let's assume that we could, see, I'm just making things up. Obviously, these things couldn't happen. I'm just trying to, for argument's sake, so you'll understand, one way or another, that if Moshe Rabbeinu could come back, okay, and would tell us and say that the whole thing was fabricated, and he had motives because he wanted to help his people and direct them in a certain way, and therefore he presented it as though it's from God, all of that, whatever the case may be, and it's irrefutable. So I maintain that it doesn't matter whether a person's basing themselves on knowledge or on faith. The faith is not sustained. Most people of faith would lose their faith because they'd see clearly. I'll prove to you from the Rambam that this is the case. The Rambam maintains that eventually, that is to say, in the days of the Messiah, all people of all religions are going to recognize the truth, that Judaism is the true religion. How so? The Rambam maintains that in spite of the fact that Christianity and Islam are great, great evils, still in all, God, in his infinite wisdom, can take something which is inherently evil and utilize it for the achievement of his purposes. And he says, he talks about the other religions. Perhaps we'll go into that. Another thing also, and that is to say that, just a parenthetic, before I go into the proof from the Rambam, that people who are completely convinced, that have faith, absolute faith in Christianity, will change their position on the basis of knowledge. I'll demonstrate that next week. Also, in terms of the person who bases himself on faith, he really can't achieve the objective. He can't really achieve a true closeness to God. Because the real objective, the real perfection is for a person to achieve Yediyas Hashem, the knowledge of God, to the greatest extent possible. And here, a person is blocking out a very significant element. The person will always have a certain conflict because there's a part of the person that doesn't acknowledge. In order for this person to go on, the person has to repress reality. Because they're not basing themselves on reality, they're basing themselves on faith. So therefore, the entire soul of the person cannot really embrace the truth of Torah and the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In order for a person to do that, it's got to be every part of the psyche has to be in line with this truth. And that means to say that a person has utilized their mind in the embrace of Torah. So for all of these reasons, I maintain that, first of all, faith is contrary to Torah. The Torah demands that we know, as Moshe Rabbeinu said to the Jews, V'yadat ha'yom, you shall know this day. V'ashevosa el lavecha, and clarify it in your heart. Ki Hashem hu Elokim, that the Lord is God. Atu harei soladas, you have seen to know. Ki Hashem hu Elokim. Moshe keeps exhorting the Jews to keep the Torah because they've seen, and as a result of what they've seen, they know. He never criticizes them for not having faith. He always criticizes them for not accessing, for not acting in accordance with the knowledge that they ought to have. Secondly, I maintain that faith is just as vulnerable. A person can have faith in something, but when you prove to that person beyond a doubt that it's false, the faith goes. They lose their faith. You see, there's a crisis of faith today in the Catholic Church on the basis of the fact that now they're seeing that all these priests that they thought were so pure are now caught up in these scandals and the cover-ups and so forth, all these defects. So many people are losing their faith. Of course, it's contrary to reality. Reality is a strong factor. So it's true, a person who lives in accordance with knowledge and reality, when it changes, he'll change his position. But a person of faith is also going to be affected and will probably change their position. The last point is that it's just a defect. It's contrary to what the Torah demands, and it's a defect in terms of the perfection, because the Torah, which maintains that the perfection of a person is, by he doubled the whole derach of maskil. That David was a maskil, used seichel and rationality in all of his ways. Hashem Imo, and God is with him. So then how, according to this person, they're saying, yeah, it's true, but not in one way. In this way, in this area, in terms of deciding which is the true religion, then I shouldn't be a maskil. That is contrary to the objective. The real perfection of the person is that he masters his emotions in every area, and in every area he acts in accordance with knowledge. So this can't be the derech. The issue of authority. That is that to what extent should a person base themselves not on things that they themselves personally understand or have knowledge of, but rather on some so-called external authority. Now, before we go any further, we're going to try and explore this issue a little bit and in different realms. You can take up this question in general, quite removed from the issue of in religion, quite removed from Judaism. You can take it up as a general question that applies to life. So let's begin. In general, if somebody were to ask you, not in the context of Judaism, to what extent, so to speak, should a person base themselves on authority? How would you approach it? What would you say is better? Is it a good thing to base yourself on authority, or not such a good thing?
Ideally,
it seems that the most effective way in which a person should live their life is through knowledge, through the attainment of knowledge. If a person denies knowledge, then you really can't continue with this discussion. Let me lower again. The Rambam has some in the guide, in the paperback edition, page 267. Chapter 11. The general topic here is on the evils. It says, all the great evils which men cause to each other because of certain intentions, desires, opinions, or religious principles are likewise due to non-existence because they originate in ignorance, which is absence of wisdom. A blind man, for example, who has no guide, stumbles constantly because he cannot see and causes injury and harm to himself and others. In the same manner, various classes of men, each man in proportion to his ignorance, bring great evils upon themselves and upon other individual members of the species. If men possessed wisdom, which stands in the same relation to the form of man as the sight to the eye, they would not cause any injury to themselves or to others. For the knowledge of truth removes hatred and quarrels and prevents mutual injuries. This state of society is promised to us by the prophet in the words, and the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the cow and the bear shall feed together, and the sucking child shall play on the hole of the asp. The prophet also points out what will be the cause of this change, for he says that hatred, quarrel and fighting will come to an end, because men will then have a true knowledge of God. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. Yes, that's very important. It's a very, very important chapter. The Rambam is saying that the most crucial thing in the life of the individual, and insofar as that person affects others, in the life of society, and so on, that all the evils stem from ignorance, false ideas. But if people, to the extent that people remove themselves from falsehood, and to the extent that they operate in accordance with the truth, to that extent, they improve their life. So therefore, there's no question that that the primary issue should be what is the most conducive method in terms of making sure that you live your life in accordance with wisdom, in accordance with knowledge. So now we have to take up the issue of authority. So I think to begin with, everybody would agree that you have no choice. On the one hand, you have no choice. There's the ideal. The ideal situation would be that if you can, that's basically what we're talking about in the situation of Mashiach, you know, some Mashiach. The ideal situation would be that in every endeavor that a person involves themselves in, they're operating on the basis of knowledge. Is that correct? When we talk about knowledge, do we mean first-hand knowledge or second-hand knowledge? But that if possible, first-hand knowledge is better than second-hand knowledge. So let's see if we can explain why.
Why is first-hand better than
second-hand? Seems to me that you have to admit that first-hand knowledge, and we're talking about genuine knowledge, is clearly superior. For a number of reasons. Let's go through the reasons. Basically, when we talk about first-hand knowledge, we're assuming it's real knowledge, that you really know. Of course, if you're making a mistake and you don't have knowledge, then it's not first-hand knowledge. But of course, you have to take into consideration that possibility. But all things being equal, assuming that you have the capability of achieving knowledge in this area. So that would seem to me to be superior. With regard to second-hand knowledge, there's a number of decisions that have to be made, all of which increase the possibility of making a mistake. Because here you don't have the absolute proof. You don't have access to the knowledge itself. So now a determination has to be made as to who is the person that does have knowledge. And that's always going to be subject to problems. Because since you yourself don't have knowledge, you can't test the person out. You can't have first-hand knowledge about the fact that this person has knowledge because you don't know the subject matter. So essentially, you're going to be using other devices. All of these devices increase the likelihood, the possibilities of mistakes. For example, you have to go to others, other experts in the field. Other experts in the field will, there's a consensus that this person is an expert. That is okay. That's something you have to live with, you have to function with, but you see that lends itself to mistakes because these people, maybe they are telling the truth, maybe they're not telling the truth, or maybe they have a general idea. The further removed you are from the truth itself, the more you increase the possibilities of distortions. Because there could be reasons why a certain person is regarded as an expert. In general, you have to go by that standard. So a mistake can be made with regard to that person. And even if that person is an expert, it doesn't mean that on every particular case he's going to have the truest opinion. It's a general rule of thumb. You're operating now with other kinds of principles. What gets me closer to the truth? Now, all this is rational. We're not saying it's not rational. Because you don't know how to treat yourself, and you're ill, so you have to go to a doctor. So a right decision has to be made. Who's the expert? Since you don't know how to determine, you have to go by others. Now you're with the opinions of others. And opinions of others can sometimes be influenced by various factors. Also, it's possible that this person is, in general, the greatest expert, but how do you know that in this particular case he's going to have the greatest expertise? There's also another issue, and that is that even if you found the right person, and this person is the best person for the situation, there's always the distortion that arises in terms of transmission. When this person transmits it to you, so distortions can come into the picture. I think there's another advantage in terms of first-hand knowledge. when you get some information or an idea from somebody else, there's always a limitation. You may have a clear transmission, and this is what he said, and you got it correctly. But you're also kind of limited in terms of the application, because you don't understand the bases for it. When you understand an idea completely, so then you have much greater flexibility in how to utilize it, how to apply it, and so on and so forth. And also the impact that it makes upon the person. So for all these reasons, I think that everybody would agree that the ideal situation would be to have first-hand knowledge, if possible, in virtually every situation where knowledge is necessary. The only thing is, we also have to recognize that that's impossible. It's impossible, and also, it's very impractical, because all progress in mankind is based, presupposes the idea of second-hand knowledge. If a person is going to insist that he can't function with anything, he can't do anything unless he himself has first-hand knowledge, he's going to have to reproduce every experiment that was ever done. And therefore, you can't have progress. All progress is based upon the idea of assuming a very, very effective system of second-hand knowledge.
He's going to have to
reinvent. Right?
He's going to have to reinvent. You
couldn't enter the society either. You couldn't go on an airplane until you were convinced on the basis of first-hand knowledge of what exactly is going on over here, of why you should believe that this airplane is going to take off and fly, even though you've seen many others taking off and flying, but how do you know that this one will? Right? It's tough.
You'll be stuck. You won't be able to move.
It's tough. It's a tough life.
You won't leave your house. Like, you'll be like in a cave or something like that.
So you're responsible to make as educated a decision as possible.
As we said, a person should seek to develop his mind to the greatest extent. Even if you can have to rely on authority, there's a world of difference whether you have knowledge in the area, even if you're not in a position to decide if the authority is correct or not, but the more you know, the more utilization you'll have from that authority. It's like in any area. If you go to a financial planner and you have no understanding at all, you just put all your trust and your money with this person. So that position is not as enviable, obviously, as someone who knows how to ask questions. This person's not an expert, but they understand how the basics are operating and what he's doing, and they can evaluate whether something makes sense or not. You'll get much more out of the authority that way, and also, he's going to be less apt to take advantage of you, that type of thing. The same is true with the doctor. It's an important thing to realize. You can't just put your life in other people's hands. It's not a good idea. Even experts. Even authorities. They're just human, and the people respond. If someone questions them and they see that this person doesn't just blindly accept what they say, that's a question you should ask. If you have an authority, should you just follow blindly? No, the answer is you should never close your mind. Assuming that you know what you're doing, you're not neurotic. You should always seek, to the best of your ability, to understand what your treatment is. Because nobody's perfect. You can't assume that this person, because they're an authority, they're perfect. And you have to realize that the way you relate to them is going to affect the treatment. Doctors respond differently to people that question and that have some knowledge of medicine and want to know why they're doing this. And you'll see that a lot of times the doctors will change their opinions. All that is extremely important. The problem emerges in the religious area, especially in Judaism, in the study of Torah. In the study of Torah, you have to be cognizant of the boundary lines. There are authorities. And we can't function without them, because you're dealing with a system that's revealed to us by God and was entrusted to certain people who have the authority to transmit the Torah. That's basically, for example, the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. Everything has been transmitted from one generation to another, and we have thousands of years, and a system has developed. And we just can't come along and start deciding on our own. We're going to determine what the halacha should be in a given case. You got to operate within the framework of the system, within the framework of the authorities. But by and large, I don't see this as being a problem if there's a machlokas, we study the machlokas. In halacha, for example, we study the machlokas to try and understand it. That's our objective, is really to try and understand it. There too, you see clearly from the system itself that why do you have to understand it? Just find out what to do, how to paskin. No, the essence of Torah is really to gain understanding. And the more knowledge you have, the more enhanced will be your observance. If there is an argument that we're not on the level to determine which position is correct, that's a basic premise. We don't maintain that Hillel and Shammai is having an argument, or anybody else having an argument, Abai and Rabba, that we're able to say who's right and who's wrong. We never say that. We try to understand both sides, but the system itself has a method of determining what the halacha shall be. So there's not really that much of a problem. Of course, the more knowledge you have, the more you're able to decide what the correct halacha is in that case. If you don't, a person has to know himself. A person has to know their level of expertise. And then a person has to be able to seek out the proper authorities. Which is not that difficult a phenomenon. See, I think the problem comes into the picture. There is a problem. When it comes to learning. Now, even if it's a non-halachic area, there are philosophical disputes. Tremendous philosophical disputes on many, many, virtually every issue. And your objective, again, is to try and increase your own knowledge, your own understanding. You also have to know where, let's say, for example, as I said, there's a machlokas, there's arguments about the nature of Mashiach. What will happen in the days of the Mashiach. Whether Mashiach, hopefully we'll cover this, whether this is synonymous with the world to come, that's the ultimate reward, will be in the Messianic era, or not. It's just a historical phenomenon, and that's quite different than the world to come, as the Rambam has it. With regard to the resurrection of the dead, is that also synonymous with the world to come? Well, no, it's not. And nothing to do with the world to come, as far as the Rambam is concerned. And many, many areas, philosophical disputes, philosophical debates. And you may say, who am I? I can't determine who's correct when you have an argument between the Rambam, the Ramban, other great Jewish thinkers and philosophers. What are you to do? All right, a person on a high enough level of understanding has a right, even in a halachic dispute, to maintain that this position makes more sense to me. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. For example, in a machlokas of Hillel and Shammai, even if we paskin, we follow the position of Hillel, intellectually, you're allowed to believe. If you're on that level, it would be foolish for an ordinary person to just, that would be superficial, mm-hmm. because of how it affects his emotion. Usually it's for trivial reasons. Well, that's foolishness, that's not knowledge. But a person with genuine knowledge that really understands the issues in their depth and can say why they prefer this position, why this position makes more halachic sense to them. But that's all fine and well. That's the case of the Zakei Mamre, the rebellious elder, who disagrees with the psak of the Sanhedrin HaGadol. That person is permitted to go back to his town and to teach his own idea, which is contrary to the accepted halacha, which was propounded by the Bezdin HaGadol, provided that he makes it clear that, in terms of observance, you have to follow the Sanhedrin. If he does not, if he paskins differently, then he's disrupting. He's attacking the whole system that the Torah Shabbat operates on, and his penalty is Misa. He's subject to the death penalty. So you see that the way the system deals with that issue in terms of authority and in terms of the value of knowledge, it's amazing. In most systems, those things that you're prohibited from propounding, you're prohibited from teaching or thinking. It's that they try and to control, to suppress the mind. And yeah, just know the essence of the system is really to obtain knowledge. So, but you have to have a system, and you can't have everybody following his own Torah, his own halacha. That's not good for the system. Unfortunately, the way we have it today, and we can't resolve a lot of these disputes, it's a problem. It's not far from ideal. It'd be better if we could subject all the various arguments that exist today that have accumulated over the centuries, and to submit them to a Sanhedrin that would make the determinations, and all the Jews would be following one Torah. That would be an ideal. Unfortunately, we don't have that Sanhedrin today because of the issue of not having smicha. That was lost in the course of history, to be restored in the days of Mashiach. So you have to have a system, and the ones who are most responsible for maintaining it are the are the ordained rabbis that people go to for guidance, for psak. The way the system deals with it is it makes a clear-cut distinction between the observance, between the psak, and between the intellectual freedom. It does not demand of anyone that they agree intellectually with the decisors, with those who have the authority to decide. That's Sanhedrin HaGadol. This is the great Sanhedrin. 71, the greatest scholars in the land, they have the ultimate authority to decide what the halacha is. Still at all, we maintain that it's possible for this one individual who's a great, great genius, he can be right, and they all can be wrong. Majority rules doesn't mean to say that the truth is always with the majority. It just means to say it's a practical method of dealing with disputes. That's the best method. So therefore, if you are a legitimate scholar and you understand, it's possible your understanding is correct, and theirs is wrong. And here you are, this genius, and you've argued the case, and you have the ability to say they're all wrong. They're all mistaken. So what are you supposed to do? Somebody comes and asks you a shayla now, and you know that the true halacha should be different. So what you have to do is to suppress that, because what they observe is determined by the Sanhedrin. That's the system. However, in the shir, when you're giving a shir, you can make it clear what the halacha is. This is what you have to observe. Now let me just explain to you why I disagree. So you have that right of disagreement. Of course, the person has to know his level. It's absurd for a person that's not on the level to disagree with scholars that are much superior to himself. In the realm of the philosophical arguments that we're talking about, for example, with regard to Mashiach, with regard to the world to come, all these types of issues, there you have a lot of leeway. You're not forced to make a decision, because the actual content, the substance of what these doctrines entail, what exactly is going to be Olam Haba, what exactly is Yemos HaMashiach, these things are not clearly spelled out in the Torah. They're only alluded to, there's allusions, there's deductions you have to make, and so on and so forth. So great scholars came to a certain conclusion, but that's essentially an opinion. That's their opinion based upon their reading of the sources, their knowledge of all of the material, the Torah Shabbat, and so forth. However, they themselves will tell you that your obligation, your halachic obligation, has nothing to do with the specifics. That is to say that you have an obligation. It's a fundamental tenet of Judaism that there's such a phenomenon as resurrection of the dead, Tchiyas HaMeisim. That's what you're obligated to believe. If you deny the phenomenon of Tchiyas HaMeisim, then you're a kofir. However, you're not obligated to take a position as to when it will happen, to whom it will happen, how does it fit into the whole system. That's not part of the requirement. The same is true with regard to Mashiach. There's no requirement in terms of the particularities. The basic requirement is that the Redeemer, that there'll be a Redeemer from the house of David, and he'll restore the power of the Jews, he'll destroy their enemies, and so forth. That's the general picture. There'll be an end of day, so to speak, a messianic era. There'll be peace, universal peace, and the true rule of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the true way of life that people were created to live, all of this will become out. People will recognize God, and that day His name will be one. He will be one, and His name will be one. The unity of God will be recognized, and the truth of the Torah will be recognized, and the false religions will be uprooted, etc. That is the phenomenon. Other than that, when you discuss, in terms of the issues, they're for matters of study. You should study them, and when you come to disputes, there you have a right to say that the position of the Rambam or the Ramban or Abba Ben Hillel, whoever it may be, makes more sense to you. Of course, a wise person would say, but still, I recognize the possibility I may be missing something over here, and I'm open to learning more. But at this point in time, you have a right to say that this is the position that makes more sense to you. Again, I caution you that it shouldn't be based on emotion or superficiality. That's not real study. And these areas, you have to be careful in those areas, because a lot of people, for example, the question as to Olam Haba, big machlokas on Olam Haba, between the Rambam and the Ramban, physical or not physical? Are you familiar with this? There's a machlokas whether the ultimate reward, the world to come, so to speak, is the life of the soul, after death, when it's, so to speak, separated from the physical. So there's a soul, there's an existence. It's an incorporeal existence. And that's what, that's the Rambam's position. Not that the Rambam, the Rambam was criticized for people maintaining that he was denying the resurrection. Because he was saying that the ultimate reward is the, is not in this physical world. That's not true. He affirms the resurrection. But that's a different thing. That's a historical phenomenon that will occur at a certain point in history. There'll be a resurrection, but that those people who are resurrected will not live eternally. There's no eternal existence in the physical form of this world. That's the Rambam's position. Eventually, ultimately, so to speak, everybody dies, and then you have the world to come. The world to come is not a future phenomenon. It means relative to the existence, the physical existence that a person has. The Ramban have maintained that it'll be in this world. That's connected, that the world to come is associated with the days of the Mashiach, with the resurrection, and all the righteous will be returned, and they'll live eternally in a perfected type of a physical existence in this universe. So those are two legitimate positions. It's not only the Ramban who maintains this way. I think Sadia held this way, and others. Now, what's the correct position? Obviously, I don't think anybody's in a position to know. The Rambam has very good reasons for his position. The Ramban has very good reasons for his position. So there's... Now, as I said before, it's not vital which position is true in terms of your obligation to believe that the phenomenon of Tchias and Mason will occur. All of the, that there is such a thing as the world to come, that a person will have eternal life. A righteous person will live and have eternal life. Whether it's in this world or whether it's not, is not vital in terms of your emunah. Because they can say, I believe in the phenomena, I don't know. I don't know what form it'll take. And then, you have permission to study. The more you study, the more certain position will make more sense to you. Are you obligated to take a stand on this issue? No, you don't take a stand. So you'll always keep your mind open. What I caution you about is what I mentioned before. You will see, guaranteed, if you have a discussion with a group of ordinary people, so to speak, balabatim, as they say, you give a lecture on the topic. I've given lectures on the topic in shuls and so forth. And then you took a poll as to which position most people think the most people would think make more sense. Which one do you think they would go for? That's going to be the popular one. But that's no indication that the arguments for that position make more sense. It's simply because that's more emotionally appealing to people. Since we can't identify, nobody, the Rambam makes it very clear that there's no way we can really visualize the joy of that existence because, well, the only pleasures we know are those that are related to sensation, to the physical, to the emotional, to the instinctual. That's our makeup. We cannot envision that type of an existence. Precisely because of that, it may be appealing to people that are on the level of the abstract. On the level of the abstract, where a person makes a decision purely in terms of the arguments, in terms of the ideas. But most people aren't like that. Most people make their decision on the basis of what's appealing to them. So a true scholar will recognize that emotion and put it aside and try and study the issue objectively. The laws that pertain to a Ben Noach, the seven Noahide laws, the question is being raised that in general they make sense on a, you know, an ordinary common sense level, that these all are essential to establishing a life, a civilized life, of course based upon the foundation of God. That's extremely important. And the obliteration of idolatry. So you didn't ask the question about idolatry. Mm-hmm. You didn't ask the question about idolatry.
I
We're going to review the seven Noahide laws. The point being that, in general, they make sense to us on a simple level. We don't have to delve too deeply to see that it's establishing the foundations of a philosophically useful way of life. So the Rambam says in the ninth chapter of Hilchos Melachim, Al Shisha Dvarim Nitzdava Adam Harishon. Adam Harishon was commanded on six things. So he had six of the seven. He didn't have all seven. Al Avodah Zarah, concerning idolatry. Idolatry is crucial. because you can't talk about a civilized order for human beings if it's rooted in idolatry, if it's not based upon the true idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the fundamentals of reality, of existence. If a person is steeped in idolatry, he's really lacking in terms of his basic functioning as a human being. Because that's part of the essential makeup of a person, is a need within the individual to have a recognition of the ultimate scheme of things, essentially as to why he exists, what is the character of his existence. And a person is completely distorted on that issue, and he can't recognize that the universe in which he finds himself, the world in which he finds himself, is not a self-sustaining phenomenon, but that he's the product of a supreme being, and even worse, that he actually begins to deify. That is, the element within him which is looking for something supreme. Everybody is a believer on some level. It's in the nature of man to deify. So there's no such thing as an absolute atheist in the true philosophical sense, because even people that deny the true God, they find a substitute. Something or other becomes their God. God that is to say that they worship, that that's the ultimate. Because really, if a person doesn't believe in God, the truth of the matter is they should really stop existing. Or just live an animalistic kind of existence. Because if there's no God, so then basically you're saying that your whole existence is an accident. So what is the point? All these people, they have a framework of values and things that ideals, and that they're important, and they're living for, and they're striving for, and they're trying to perpetuate. But what's the point? The whole thing is just an accident. So how can you say that something or other has significance? How could it be significant? It came into being as a result of an accident. If you're telling me that the very foundation of reality is all accidental and meaningless, purposeless, absolutely meaningless, there's no reason, no rhyme. It's all, that's what you're saying. If you're saying it's all an accident, so now after the fact, how can something begin to be important and have meaning and significance when the whole picture is an accidental phenomenon? Do you swallow the absorb that? It's manufacturing it. It doesn't exist. That's all true. All this talk about meaning in life and a purpose and a direction and all of that is true if you started with the basic premise that life itself has some reason, some rhyme and reason, some goal, some purpose. If you assume that, that this is why the world exists and this is what it was created for and this is the objective, so then in our own framework we try to adjust ourselves towards that objective. But if after all said and done, this whole universe is just an accident, didn't have to come into being at all, aside from the question is that if that's the case, then it can just go out of existence just as accidentally. That everything's just an accident. So what's the point? What are you striving after? It's an accident. So you just realize that you happen to be an unintended consequence of a certain accident. So then what are you going to do? It's going to last for a while. Either you could remove yourself, because you don't want to be here. There's no reason why you should be here. It's all an accident. You face the consequences of that. And or else you don't want to kill yourself, so then just plan to do something. Well, why do people have all these plans about the future and humanity and mankind? It's meaningless. There's no basis for it at all. It's not true. Ultimately, it's not true because the whole thing is an accident. People don't realize the consequences of not believing in God. The person doesn't believe in the Creator. There's no basis for all of the humanitarian concepts and ideals. I just pointed out recently in a class that if you don't believe in God, there's no idea of human rights. I was explaining the concept of Yahavta L'Recha Kamocha, you should love your friend as yourself. That's only conceivable if a person believes in the foundations, the existence of God, and the world exists because of the will of God. In that framework, then each individual is endowed by the Creator with rights and so forth. If you deny the Creator, then you deny any type of morality whatsoever. Let's think about that for a minute. if there's no creator and you follow that train of thought, so then you're just an accident and I'm just an accident. Just happens to come into existence through some indifferent processes which nobody can understand. Now, that proposition itself is kind of irrational as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't make any sense. You're basically saying that something comes into existence from nothing. So it doesn't appeal to my mind, the whole idea. But I'm going to follow through on the consequences, the logic of those who want to maintain that way. That there's all you find yourself in existence as a result of an accident. And then I look around and I see other existences whose life has no meaning whatsoever. You're telling me that I should respect, that I have to respect you, that you have a right. Where do you get a right from? You're just an accident. So what right do you have? On what basis do you have any rights? Why shouldn't I kill you if you get in my way? Why shouldn't I gag every... I'm just a existing... I'm like an animal. I'm just a being that exists for one thing. Satisfaction of what I want. That would be the only logical conclusion. For a person to do anything, to engage in any activity which is outside of the realm of the satisfaction of his immediate desires, would be absolutely absurd. Even to work for mankind would be absurd, unless you could get something out of it. Selfishness would be the only principle. Now, if... I know people will say, well, if that's the case, you're gonna, if you kill the other guy, he'll kill you. That's a practical utilitarian type of an approach, which is not what we're talking about. Because in that framework, yeah, you're right. I wouldn't kill you if I was concerned that your friends would kill me. I would only confine myself to killing people that I feel confident wouldn't get that, like a sniper. According to that framework, what's wrong with the sniper? Whatever the benefit or reason he's getting, why is he a horrible person? Perhaps that's his philosophy. You can't condemn the person until you know his philosophy. If that's his philosophy, so then there's nothing wrong with him. He's not immoral. It shows you how shallow people are. The thinking of people about significant issues is very, very shallow. That's my proposition. Yeah. There's no morality. There's no basis of morality, humanitarianism, all of these concepts. If they deny the Creator, then they're absolutely without any validity whatsoever. There's no concept of human rights if it's outside of the framework of a supreme being who established a system, and he's the one who determines what shall be and what shall not be, what's right and what's wrong. Then you have an idea of right and wrong. There's no right and wrong if there's no system. If life is an accident, then anything goes. But then what difference does it make anyway? The whole thing's an accident. Who cares? Who cares if you're destroying this or you're destroying that? The whole thing is just an accident anyways. And it may self-destruct in 2 minutes. Why would a person have any confidence at all that anything is going to continue? Because just like it came into being as a complete accident, it may go out of existence as a complete accident. This whole thing is a worthless endeavor. Think through the consequences. I don't want to depress anybody, because I assume you don't have that premise. But you better get God quickly, or else you're going to get very depressed. Or you may go possible to have any system of right and wrong,
right,
that's going to be objective, because then you're going to have to go towards utilitarian, whatever is useful. Whatever is useful means that there's nothing inherently good or bad about this. It's just a question of consequences. So then it's up to the person. Each person decides for himself what his considerations are and what the consequences are for him. So if the person decides that in his system it's better for him to be a robber, and that gives him the greatest satisfaction, there's no way that you can say that it's wrong. Because you can't say that there's any virtue in hard work or anything else. Because you can't talk about an ideal. There's no basis. There's no objective. It's an accident. All you could say is that working hard and being thrifty and all that is good. It works for you. It's a good way to live. That's all you could say. To which the other person who steals the money will say that it is a good way. It's a good way for you. Good way for me to wait around and steal what you earn. That's the way it goes in the animal kingdom. Take a look. There are some animals that wait until other animals make a catch, they wait around and they chase them away and they run off with the kill. Right?
You're right,
I was right and wrong to the animal kingdom. No intelligent person. Because it's all governed by pure instinct. And that makes sense. Now, if we assume God, and then man is different, and he's endowed with the soul, so then you can't make the leap from the animal kingdom to man. You have to judge man in a different realm. But if you don't make that, if you don't believe in that, and you don't believe in God, you don't believe in man being a higher form of existence, so then it's just an instinctual phenomenon, so man should follow his instincts. Now, of course, his intelligence will tell him that in certain cases it's not good to follow his instinct. That's something else. That's a different type of control of the instinct. It's essentially controlling the instinct in order to gain more instinctual gratification. So therefore, a person will control his anger and will not attack another person who is stronger than he is. Just because he's angry, then he won't do it. He'll control his instinct. But that's instinctual. Animals are the same way. But what other principles should a person adopt except that principle? That he's just here for a short while because of an accident, and there's nothing that he can achieve. There's no achievement. It's all in the mind. It's all illusory. And the only thing is, all these other things are nonsensical. To try and get a name for himself and be remembered and be in history, whatever, that's all absurd. It's all imaginary. It's not real. It has no value whatsoever. So, there is no value, there's just your existence, that's all there is. That's it, just your existence. And anything that gives you pleasure is good, and anything that gives you pain is bad. That's how you'd look at it. And I would agree with that, if that were the foundation of reality. It's amazing how people don't think through the consequences of being an atheist. And so we're continuing with the idea of the Shalom Mitzvah B'nai Noach. And yesterday we discussed the idea of Avodah Zarah and what the entire foundation of any type of a civilized existence, a human existence. As we know, it is possible only on the foundation of the Creator. So he's commanded with regard to the prohibition of Avodah Zarah. The Al-Pirkas Hashem. Birkas Hashem is a euphemism. It really means the opposite. It would be, so to speak, a curse to utter what would be considered to be a curse of Hashem. And that's a very complex area in terms of what exactly would the person say which would constitute a curse, so to speak. Blasphemy is the way it's described. That's the term that's utilized. That's a very serious avera, and it carries the death penalty. You have to curse a fellow Jew. And what's considered a curse is when you utilize the Shem Hashem. That is, for example, to say God damn you to a certain individual. To say those words would constitute a curse, according to the Torah. Because you're utilizing the name of God for the sake of, so to speak, cursing somebody else. Of the prohibition of cursing. It's something that everybody senses is wrong. To elucidate it philosophically is not so simple. It requires thought and study to get to the root of what the evil is about, the serious evil. But over here, we're not talking about that. We're talking about something which is even more preposterous, sounds very, very preposterous, that a person would seek to utilize the mechanism of a curse against the Creator himself. And it has to actually, because there's a lot of technicalities in terms of halacha, it has to be done with the Shem Hashem. Being in both senses, as being the subject and the object, so to speak. That is, in the sense that Yaka Yossi es Yossi is the way to Gemara. That God, so to speak, should be the one who... Because the idea in reality, you can't curse God. If a person has a true idea, the whole thing is absurd. But anyway, there's a lot of complexities over there. So that's something which is more serious, but it, in a sense, it's more difficult to understand. What kind of a person is uttering it? What's motivating it? What type of a distortion? What kind of corruption is this? Because either a person recognizes God or doesn't recognize God. That seems to be the way it breaks down. So those who don't recognize God deny it. They don't curse God. They don't believe in God. They don't believe in God. They don't believe in God. There's no point in cursing. On the other hand, those who believe in God, believe in God. So we respect God. God is the creator. God is the supreme being. So this kind of a notion is very, very complicated. It appears to be some type of a distortion of the psyche. And it carries a death penalty. That's the case that's actually recorded in the Torah. I'm going to take that up with regard to that being one of the seven Noahide laws. In general, it's acceptable because we recognize that it's very serious. It's a very serious violation. So even if you don't understand it specifically and the mechanisms behind it, it's not challenging to us in the sense that why should this be one of the seven Noahide laws? That question arises if you're talking about something which we recognize is wrong, but we don't regard that, we don't see at first sight why that should be so significant. That's the question that's been raised with regard to the prohibition of Avram and Achai, a limb from a living animal. That's something where the question has been raised. Why, of all the different prohibitions in Torah, why is that so significant that it warrants a place among the seven? Next one is Shvichas Damim, murder. That we understand. That's Motirtach. Thou shalt not murder. That's one of the Aseres HaDibros, the Ten Commandments. So the foundation of any type of a civilized system of life obviously has to be the prohibition against murder. So that makes sense to us. The Algili Arayos and forbidden sexual relations. That also makes sense to us. That's also in the Aseres HaDibros. Or Tinnah, that adultery, so to speak, but other cases of forbidden sexual relations. In order to establish a society that's productive, that's creative, it means to say that a person has to gain control over the sexual, has to establish boundaries. Societies which give in to the emotions, to the instincts, are completely consumed by the sexual, eventually they dissipate. It's a major, major problem. You see it happening in our society today in terms of the breakdown of the sexual controls, the so-called sexual revolution, which has been going on for about 30 years now, and all these different movements that come to the fore in terms of gays, gay rights, and along with this you have abortion rights and so forth. This is a dangerous phenomenon for society. And by the way, this is relevant to the Dharma model. The two major sins of the Dharma model were the sexual area, the failure to impose controls, the loss of controls in the sexual, and then it spilled over into the relations between people in terms of the inability to respect the rights of others, the violent factor. That we understand. Then it mentions the Alek Gezel, theft. That's obviously a fundamental. People can't engage in any kind of productive activity if there's theft. You have to have protection. Yeah. Obviously, no one's going to bother working. Well, and that's going to lead to murder, and it's going to lead to a destruction. So you can't have any kind of productivity in a society. All these things are extremely serious. We fail to take note of it. There's a lot of theft in our society today, maybe in a more sophisticated fashion, corporate theft and all these scandals in the stock market, insider trading and things of that sort. Gezel. The Yahadinim. Dinim would be that they have to set up a judicial system, a court system, to enforce the others. Okay? Says Hosef Lenoach Abram and Achai, that these were the six. They remained in existence until Noach after the flood, and God added for Noach and of course all subsequent generations Abram and Achai. the limb of a living animal. Shenemar ach basar benafsho damo benafsho damo lo sochelo. That's a reference to the fact that as long as the animal is alive, you're not going to eat it, which means to say that it seems to be basic humane method of dealing with animals. That before you're permitted, permission was granted to eat meat, but the animal has to be killed properly first. As far as Jews are concerned with shechita, as far as Goyim are concerned, they don't require shechita. It's only for Jews. But nevertheless, the animal must be killed. Must be killed humanely. The Rambam is not talking about that now, but that's included. But the point at which it would become a violation would be that the person partook of the animal before it was dead. I mean, basically that the animal cannot be eaten from until it's dead. So, for example, if the animal was slaughtered, shechita, kosher slaughter, that in certain cases there'll be a difference between how the law works for a ben noach, for a noachite, and for a Jew. Basically, once the animal has been slaughtered properly, and even if it's still shaking, then at that point it's no longer considered to be Eiver Menachai. For a guy, the animal has to be dead. Alright, but the question that we're interested in is, why does this assume such significance? Well, what you really have to do is to undertake a bit of an investigation of the significance of Eiver Menachai. Okay, I guess the first part, I'm a correct test, voracious. After the marvel, so God addresses Noah. Certain changes are instituted. For example, the phenomenon of the fear, that animals are now given a fear of man. Then it says, in that same pasuk, that everything, all the various creatures are given over to your hands, something which didn't exist before. Every animal, so to speak, that's alive, I'm giving you to eat. Well, no restrictions have been placed on Noah in terms of which animals he can eat. The idea of prohibited species, that's part of the Torah, that's for the Jews. Kiyarek Esav, Chasati Lachem is called. That it's just like the grasses or the vegetables, so to speak, which there's no restriction. A person can have whatever he wants. So, too, I've given you all the animals. Ah! Basar Benafsho Damo, Basar Benafsho Damo, Loso Chelo. That the flesh, where the blood is still in it, the blood meaning the life. Meaning that it's still alive. So flesh of an animal that's still alive, you may not eat. That's a limitation. Ach. Now in that case, then it mentions v'achas bimchem l'nafsho seichem. Now it goes on to Adam. And your own blood of your soul, that means your own life. Edrosh miyat kolchaya. Edrosh miyat kolchaya edroshenu. I will demand, so to speak. Demand means I'll hold it accountable. In terms of avenging, there's an accountability for the killing of people. Miyat kolchaya ed rishenu. According to Rashi, it means that if an animal kills a person, so God will hold the animal responsible, so to speak, even though there's no true responsibility by an animal. But that animal will be punished. Umiyat adam, and from the hands of man, Miyad ish achiv edrosh is nefesh adam. Yeah. Say, basic idea is that whoever kills, that any person that kills, God will demand his punishment, his life. And then it's reiterated, shofech dam ha adam, one who spills the blood of man, ba adam damo yishavech. That his blood shall be spilled by Adam. Adam. Because God created man in the Tzelem Elokim, in the image of God. And there's many ideas that are implied over here. Rashi connects the two ideas. Take a look at Rashi and hey, the achas dimchem, but your blood, afalpi shehatarti lachem tilas neshama babahema, even though I permitted the taking of the so-called soul, it's not the same soul. I mean, to destroy the life force of the animal, as dimchem edrosh, I will demand the blood, may ashofich dam atzmo, from someone who spills his own blood. That's a reference to suicide. So Rashi learns that the immediate subject that comes after is the subject of killing Adam. It starts off with suicide. Then it goes on to killing other people. Let's take a look at what's done with Rashi. Dimchem lenafsho seichem. So Rashi says, afachonek atzmo. Afalpi shelo yotzu mimenu dam. Even one who chokes himself, even if no blood went forth. That's very difficult for me to understand. What's the difficulty? The problem with this is, why do I need a specific reference to choking oneself? Once we've learned that suicide is prohibited, what difference does it make how it's done, whether there's actual physical blood? When we use the term spilling blood, we don't mean necessarily that the actual blood came forth, that you killed someone. So most of the time that means spilling the blood, but there could be other ways. You could poison someone. You could choke someone. So I don't think once you told me that I'm not permitted, that no one's permitted to commit suicide, I would no longer have any doubt, or so you can't slash your wrist. So then someone, what about choking yourself? So what's the difference? I say, what's the difference? What difference does it make the manner? Or taking an overdose? Rashi creates a difficulty for us because Rashi is saying that the pasuk had to come and tell you, even after it told you that you can't commit suicide, it had to tell you that you can't choke yourself because you might have thought that it's only when blood is spilled. That's very difficult for me to understand. Why would I have thought that? You follow? Rashi on miyat kol chaya. Because Rashi learns that that's what it's saying, that God will demand the blood, even if an animal kills a person. Obviously the problem with that is that it's different. If an animal kills someone, you can't say that the animal committed a sin.
Yeah.
The animal just operates according to its instincts. So what's the purpose, what's the point of God taking revenge? Now, in a human society, if an animal should kill, like a dog, a wild dog should kill a person, then the society should execute the animal. Of course, it's because it's dangerous, but even aside from that, it's making a point. It's establishing a point.
Yeah.
The value of human life. That this is extremely important. So therefore people in general would be much more careful if they have pets that are aggressive, whatever. In terms of doing something which expresses our regard for human life, so then you would kill an animal that killed a person. That would make sense. But here it's saying that God will do so. That is to say, it implies that even if it's not in the context of a society, it's in the woods, it's in the wilderness, and any animal that should kill, a lion or whatever it is, a man-eater, so God will take the revenge. That's hard for us to understand, because what's the point? What purpose does that serve? Okay? Rashi and Miyad Kol Chaya. Rashi says, L'fi shechatu do hamavol, because the generation of the flood sinned. V'hufkaru l'machal chayos roz, lishlots v'hen. And then they became hefker, so to speak, to be eaten by wild beasts, to rule over them. Shenemra, he says, nimshal kabahemos nidmu. They're akin to the animals. They became like animals. Laficha chutzrich lahazir aleim esachayos. Therefore, it was necessary to warn, so to speak, the chayos, the animals. Interesting. Abahemos nidmu, the way the Medrash is learned, nimshal is from Moshel. So nimshal would mean, according to the Medrash, he has become ruled. He has become dominated, so to speak, by the animals. Kavehenos nidmo, because they became similar to animals. But it's to say that this is the idea of the Midrash, that when his status went down in the generation of the Mabel, they lost all sense of control. which is based upon the Tzelem Elokim, and they began to live like animals. So therefore, because they became like animals, they then became prey to the animals. Whatever the case is, a barrier was broken down. And then they were subject to being killed by the animals. That's the sense that Rashi means. Yeah, therefore, the Ficha Chutzrach, because of this situation that developed in the time of the Mabul, the Torah needed to warn, so to speak, to establish a warning to the animals not to kill man. Of course, that's very, very difficult, because what kind of a warning? It doesn't make sense in the ordinary way of understanding things. A warning is only for those who hear the warning. Animals don't have intelligence on that level. So by God proclaiming in the Torah that God would hold every animal accountable, it's not a warning. It can't be understood that way. The idea of placing some kind of a limitation on the animals is in the pasuk itself. In pasuk Beis it says, "Morachem v'chitchem yia," that God is placing the fear of man in the al kochai haret, on all the beasts of the field, of the land, the al kol of shamayim. That is to say that this is a change. Okay, this is the Torah is telling us where that comes from. That it wasn't that way all the time, but this was brought about by a special intervention, so to speak, of God after the flood. Before the flood, it didn't exist. That fits in with the idea of Chazal that the nature of Adam was tremendously changed. I explained last week that before the flood, Adam was the most powerful creature in existence. So he was stronger than any other animal, so there was no need for a special fear. But as a result of the weakened state after the Mabul, Adam was in a weakened state. So then there was a danger that he would be killed by the animals. That danger is much greater in ancient times than today. Today we have the weapons and so forth to protect ourselves much, much better. But in those days, it would have been a serious problem if the animals would have attacked man. They would have come out of their forests and whatever and attacked man. Man lived more in the open. So therefore, God is redressing that by changing the nature of animals so that even though they're more powerful than man, but they have a natural fear. What are you looking at me like? I said